Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traverse the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And as always, hit that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all, because born in the mothership is Matthew Campagna. You know him as the writer-director of Six Reasons Why. He is now the writer and director of Six Guns for Hire and 6 Days to Die. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Campagna. Thank you so much for coming to the Traverse the Stars podcast.
My pleasure, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Totally my pleasure, sir. I've enjoyed watching your movies. I look forward to talking about your others.
Awesome. That's great.
So I always start off with a question of inspiration. What inspired your love for movies and who were your earliest influences?
Oh, interesting. I'd say from like a Western perspective, it's Sergio Leone and Clint Eastwood. But from a sci-fi perspective, it's James Cameron.
I can definitely see that Clint Eastwood vibes when I was watching Six Reasons Why. I was like, yeah, no, I see it. It's right there.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's you know, it's funny, in Six Reasons Why, it's like early in your career as a filmmaker, I feel like one of the first things you do is you try to like ape the things you love. And then as you start to find your feet, you begin to synthesize your own style. But Six Reasons Why, I just leaned into the Westerns that I loved from the 60s, those revisionist Westerns about a absolute son of a bitch coming to town and doing something for himself that happens to work out for other people.
Well, I agree 100%. You got to crawl before you can walk, right?
Absolutely.
So I read that you attended Toronto Metropolitan University, where you earned a bachelor's in high definition film. So why did you choose that university, and how did that prepare you for what you do now? And what is it between high definition film and maybe just film in general?
Well, when I was choosing a university, there was one particular place that had a radio and television arts program. All the other places had film or communications, and they were places where you would sit down and think about movies a lot, but you wouldn't get to like get your hands dirty. I went to TMU because it was as much an engineering course as it was a film and television history course. So I was able to watch the movies that impacted me the most and really go into like DVD special features and stuff like that and learn all that stuff myself. But at the time that I was choosing schools, it was the first place that had these $250,000 high definition film cameras, the kind of stuff that George Lucas was using, the Genesis cameras, and Rodriguez was using, these new digital high definition film cameras. And I kind of felt like shooting film would be not only expensive, but also less and less popular the more this high definition film technology was evolved and available. So I guess I was right, because it turns out I've never shot a frame of celluloid film in my life. Everything has been digital.
So can you go, we're to backtrack just a little bit. You're saying about how this school is more engineering based as well. So what does that mean? Because I don't think a lot of novices or like me, who are totally ignorant of the film world, would, when they think engineering, I'm thinking of like the Enterprise. They're like building, you know, the warp engines or some crazy
Jordan
thing.
Forge, yeah. Well, the thing about the engineering side that I liked was filmmaking is usually a gigantic team of hundreds of people. And so I always looked at it, partially because my brother was a chef, I looked at a filmmaking team the way that a chef looks at a line in the restaurant. And if there's no person whose job you understand 100%, you just can't do the job of being in charge of those people. Mm-hmm. And so what mattered the most to me was making sure that every role along the way, whether you were the sound recordist or the sound designer, whether you're the cinematographer, whether you're the director, whatever the job was, I wanted to be able to understand it and fire that person and replace them myself if necessary. Maybe it's because as a kid, I played a lot of solo sports. I don't know. It wasn't really, team sports weren't really my thing. Right. So it took me a while to get into this idea of the group works well together and you get to make something, but I wanted to be able to do every job myself, which came in pretty handy in Six Reasons Why, because that was like six guys in the desert and four of them were on camera. So it was a very small team of people making that movie for a good 90% of photography. And I think that really cued me up for all of the films I've made since then, because part of the reason we were able to make a movie in the pandemic at all was because I was able to be the entire camera department back before vaccines were available. Because, you know, I've got friends who are on Star Trek, which also shoots in Toronto. And the number of COVID cases that are going through the crew and causing every schedule to blow up every week is brutal. But if you have a smaller crew, there's fewer points of infection. And so you're able to move forward no matter what.
So when you're directing one of your films, let's say Six Reasons Why, Six Men for Hire, we'll get to later, any of these films. Now, because you know the ins and outs of these different departments, how's that affecting the decision you're making as a director, going that you may have an insight into a particular job that maybe somebody else wouldn't have who's not you?
Sure. Well, you know, it's been an interesting evolution from a movie like Six Reasons Why, where my brother and I and some pals went to the desert with a camera and just we were all on the same team and we were all just we all knew exactly the movie we were going to make because I had storyboarded frame for frame. We knew exactly what we were going to do. On something like 6 Days to Die, that was a film that we did for technically like $4 million as opposed to going into the desert with 10 grand and a wing and a prayer. So on a movie like that, you know, there's departments, the legal department on that alone was bigger than my entire crew on Six Reasons Why. So, you know, a movie like that, there are people who are experts at the corner of film they do, the accountants, the lawyers, the people who I was absolutely never going to have an expertise, but when it came to the props, the costumes, every element of 6 Days to Die, I was sort of the head of all the heads of department. That's the interesting job a director has. But when you're a director who built the costumes on your last movie, the conversations you have with your costume designer are a bit more fulsome. So I was able to be very specific about the world that these characters inhabit. And so right down to the costume materials that were being used, I got into the nitty gritty with Vanessa Wishart, who was the costume designer on that film. When it came to the production design, I was one of the lead production designers on 6 Days to Die because we couldn't have too many people in a room. So I was going to be the person who knew what the right prop was at the right time. And so we had a huge table of props and someone whose job it was to make sure everything was back where it belonged. But ultimately, the props were kind of my department as well, because I brought a good chunk of them from Six Reasons Why, and I purchased some other ones. So it's when you're trying to make a movie this with the kind of scope of Aliens and like an eighth, no, a tenth the budget, even back then, you wind up having to do a lot of jobs yourself. And thankfully, we were in a scenario where I wasn't going to be called a crazy tyrant. I was going to be called a one-man band because we couldn't have 100 people on set. We were 5 months into a pandemic and nobody wanted to go on set. It was a terrifying idea. So we figured out a way to make sure it was kind of just me, my wife, one actor at a time. My wife was one of those actors. Like, being able to keep the tiniest possible crew meant that the weird thing I had done on Six Reasons Why was suddenly the only way forward in a post-pandemic world.
Well, it must be rough to be a one-man band when if anything goes wrong, you can't blame anybody but yourself. You're like, you can't be like that goddamn sound guy. That's why that happened. But you're like, that's me.
Yeah, I was very fortunate on this one that every department except for sound, I did have my sound designer from Six Reasons Why on 6 Days to Die, and I've had him in like every movie. So that was the one department that I was able to hand off to somebody that I trusted with my life. He's like my brother. Nick Mondogno was my sound guy, and yeah, without him, I'd be making silent pictures.
So you're well known for your, like I said, this Western trilogy of movies that you're working on, which starts with, like, as I was saying, with Six Reasons Why, which is a really fun movie. Now, what is it about Westerns that you love so much? Because a lot of popular opinion was always that Westerns are a dying breed of movie. You know, you had a few like Tombstone that's popular. I think you had, what was it, something, 3:10 to Yuma that was popular. For the most part, the rule of thumb is don't do a Western. So what is it about Western that you love and you go, screw it, I'm going to make the damn Western, and they're going to come to a movie that I want them to see?
Well, I've got to say, part of it was the idea of the blue ocean and the red ocean. You know, I love genre film. I love horror. I love sci-fi. I love Westerns. I love stuff that really has, that takes the world we're in and sort of twists it and goes at it at a different angle. You can tell stories that might feel prescriptive if it was just happening in 2022, but if it's happening in some, you know, far off planet or some undisclosed time, suddenly people sort of come in a little more wide-eyed, willing to learn a world that's being built. So a Western was just not a thing I was watching very many of that were new. It just so happened I was raised in a barn. My mother loved horses. And so I mucked out stalls as a kid. Like that was just a thing I was used to. I lived in a funny little town that had like binder twiner festivals and demolition derbies. And so it was a cool little small town upbringing that really put the Western genre in my life day to day. But I just fucking love the way a person looks with a cowboy hat on. And there's just something about the way that light crosses the eye. And there's just this darkness. Like there's a beautiful cinematic history with the Western genre. And that's why George Lucas, and I mean, that's why Miller makes such great Westerns when he makes a Mad Max film. Like these are Westerns. In fact, Terminator 2 is the definition of a Western. The outlaw comes to town. Another bandit comes to town, is going after that outlaw. They hop on their motorcycle that's just their steed, and off they go. Like the tropes of Westerns have been written and rewritten and turned into these cool sci-fi films for decades now. And so I wanted to do one that had a bit more of the cowboy hat, but still had the undisclosed time that had technology that didn't make sense being there, things that felt anachronistic. I wanted a wasteland that was like nothing anyone had to pass in history. I wanted to build something new, and that let me change things that I find a bit boring in Westerns. There are very few deeply wealthy, powerful women or people of color in a Western. If you're gonna base it in 1888, that's just the world that they had to play with when they were writing Unforgiven. So I wanted something where all bets were off, where gender, sexuality, where race, religion, where everything was kind of put in the pop-o-matic bubble and tossed again, and you had something new. And so that was the attraction to me. There were things I loved about Westerns, and there were things that I thought were a trap. So I found a way to Kobayashi Maru the Western.
I like that reference. Well done. One trick of the Western, and you kind of hit on it just a little bit already, is relevancy. To keep what's in the West important to those modern audiences who are looking at their cell phones while they're watching the movie. So how do you keep it relevant beyond what you already mentioned, such as inclusivity and things of that nature, to the modern audience?
Well, I like doing things that completely shock the viewer. Whether it's speeding Mustang in the middle of a Western shootout, or it's a battery that someone finds in the middle of a trade in a desert. Things that don't really belong there and make an audience suddenly go, wait, what's that? That to me is what keeps things relevant. Curiosity, keeping audiences asking questions, because, you know, audiences are very sophisticated now. There are films you can watch from 10, 20, 30 years ago, and you watch as the filmmaker spoon feeds things to the audience. And now we live in a much more sophisticated media landscape where everything is like self-referential and hyper-dense, and you're throwing 1980s references to people who only know them because of the nostalgia that's been coming out. They haven't actually seen the original source material, which goes back into the idea that the original source material from the 80s was probably pirated from some idea in the 50s. So, like, you know, John Carpenter's got a great version of The Thing, but it's not the first. You know, there are these ideas that we continually recycle as a race of storytellers. And I feel like this is just another chapter. And the trick is drawing people in with questions. They've got to always want to know the answer to something. And if I can keep people asking questions for 89 minutes and in the 90th minute they get an answer that makes them reconsider the whole movie, they might just watch it all again.
So in 2008, you started filming Six Reasons Why. And then later, recently, you're in post-production of two more films in what was calling the trilogy, being 6 Days to Die and 6 Guns to Hire. So a lot of questions there. First off, that's a bit of a gap from 2008 when you reached the first one to what's eventually will be either 2022 or 2023 of a release. So what happened in the meantime? Why later did you decide to do this trilogy? And how did those two movies fit with the original movie of that trilogy?
All right. Well, that gap is an interesting thing because I got sort of noticed after making a movie for $10,000 that got in a $250,000 bidding war. And it was only sort of noticed because that's not exactly winning an award at Sundance and then getting picked up by Columbia to make a whole other movie on their dime. But I got hired by, you know, Sony and the guys that make Hell on Wheels and Fargo to write them a post-apocalyptic mutant Western movie because they liked my jam. And so I wrote 14 drafts of that until it went to Lens, and it is a frigging wild ride of a NBC Universal sci-fi movie of the week. It was very fun because I wanted to play in that world. I wanted to see the Universal logo before a movie that I wrote. And you know, I was a new director at the time, so I didn't even get to direct it. I directed splinter units, and I got to watch how the sausage was made on the larger side of things, because that was like $1.5 million, that budget. It was supposed to be $1.2 million, and then the more they did the things I wrote, the more it turned into $1.5 million. And, you know, it was cool. I enjoyed all the people I worked with, but at the end of the day, it wasn't the movie that I would have made. Mm. It was the movie that collection of people who the producers put together made. And then I worked with some other producers on some other projects, and I started to realize that the reason Six Reasons Why came together exactly the way I wanted it to was because it was my money. It was my idea. Nobody could stop me. Mm. And so it took me about 15 years to come around to the fact that if I'm not the absolute top producer involved in this film, it's somebody else's film. And, you know, Chris Nolan can get what he wants from a studio for a while, but eventually even Warner Brothers betrayed him. And so if it's not Chris Nolan's money, it's not really his movie either. And so I got into a place where it seemed like the best thing for me to do was to build my own film studio and my own streaming service my own infrastructure top down, vertically integrated, and across all media, so that I'd be able to take all the engineering that I could do and add it to all of the business that I had learned over the years and make something that could support a much bigger movie if it came out of my head. And so it took me like 5 years. My wife and I built Highball TV, and we took an idea that I had when I was at the Toronto Metropolitan University, which was, wouldn't it be nice if one day I owned my own studio and I just made it? All that engineering, all that business acumen that I learned the hard way came together and became something that I was able to basically parlay into a gargantuan loan. And as soon as I could get a gargantuan loan that I knew how I could pay back, I made a film with my own money. A much bigger, much more expensive, much more risky film. Because, you know, when you make a movie for 10 grand, if you sell it for 9 grand, you only lost, you know, $1,000. But, you know, you make a movie for $4 million, if you sell it for $3 million, uh-oh. So it was a real trick making sure that I had a way to build a thing, make a movie, and then ensure that I wasn't going to be somehow deeply out of money at the end of it. So that was the trick.
So you're making, like I said, you're basically making two movies about the same amount of time. Is that genius or insanity?
You know, a bit of column A and a bit of column B. I think if I was ever given the opportunity to do two movies back to back like this again, I would put a few bits of infrastructure in place that I've learned would have been really helpful on this one. You know, I do enjoy learning something myself. And so I figured out that a post-production supervisor is a pretty helpful dude to have when you're in the middle of shooting a whole other movie and posting the last one. So, you know, there are certain roles that really have been able to support me a lot. And I've been very thankful for my post-production supervisors. But I had a friggin' blast. And I'm still doing some of the visual effects with my visual effects team on Six Guns for Hire. So, you know, it's all working its way through the pipeline. And we're figuring out what our festival premiere for 6 Days to Die is. And we're already looking ahead to what the festival premiere for Six Guns for Hire will be.
So are these sequels to Six Reasons Why? Or if not, what is the through line that obviously they're connected? You're calling them a trilogy. The six is obviously in all titles for a purpose. So are they technically sequels to one another, to the original? What is the relationship between these movies?
I plan to make six films around a particular family and the story that they tell from being exiled from a society to finding their way back to it and ultimately cracking that society wide open. And so this is Six Reasons Why is the fifth movie chronologically. 6 Days to Die is the first movie chronologically. And Six Guns for Hire is the third movie chronologically. So I'm kind of filling in moments with stories that are their own single transformational event, but grab a character from another film and show another moment in their lives and the way that they interact with another character in one of the other films that they never met. Hmm. So now this is the moment where these two characters meet, what those two characters did when they were together. And so there's a through line of these six films that I want to do that tell this family story, but it's also a really interesting post-apocalyptic world. And so a friend of mine that is a director that I've produced in the past, he and I have been working on a duology of a samurai Western series that take place in the same world. And then I wrote with another friend of mine what I really have come to think of as the origin story for this post-apocalyptic world. I wrote that one, that's a separate one as well. So there's like nine movies in this story just now. And I've only made three of them and written six. So there's a lot more in the sixth verse in the in this post-apocalyptic neo-Western world. And as long as people keep watching these movies, I'm just going to keep making them.
So this is, like you said, a six-movie franchise. You've done movies 1, 3, and 5. Now, movies 2, 4, and 6 are already written?
2 has been written, 4 is in outline, and 6 has been outlined as well. And then there's 3 other movies that have been written that are completely, that are tangential in that the characters don't overlap, but it's the same world.
So another trick, and once again, genius or insanity, I think that's really like the theme of our interview. Once again, a challenge that I would imagine is when you make movies 1, 3, and 5, you've written 2, you've outlined, you said 4. What happens when you're an idea from 2 or 4 affects what you were going, you want, you had already done in 5? I mean, is there a continuity? Like, are you mapped it out so you made sure that all the dots still will always connect? Is there a concern ever that, what if that 5 is already out there now, and now 4 to make this what I really want to do is going to affect 5? I mean, how is this all working out in your head?
There's a madman / genius whose work I've always loved, J. Michael Straczynski, who wrote Babylon 5.
Big fan of his?
And he's great.
Rising Stars, I love it.
Yeah, it's his work is incredible. And I feel like after the first season of Babylon 5, when he was told, you know, the show's really great, just get rid of your star. And the man had mapped out 5 years of storyline wrapped around that man.
Yeah.
And he had to figure out, well, how do I still tell that story? Because there are episodes that I've shot the first half of that people won't see until the 4th year of this show. So how do I adapt what I've done with the new things I've learned, which is I can't have this actor anymore? Well, I like to think that there is magic in the teamwork that filmmaking is. And so as new actors come in and new and characters that I've written to do a little thing suddenly do something way more interesting when we're shooting, that gives me the latitude I need to make choices about who I want to move where, if there's a character that I hadn't planned on having in 5, but who really popped in 4, maybe they come back in 5, in a way that I wouldn't have known when outlining it. But being in it and building the film, it both in on set with the actor and then in post with the performance, that gives me an opportunity to then shape and massage what was an outline into something that can really make the most of the ingredients that I didn't know I was going to have.
Mm. Has it happened yet where you've had an idea for a character, but the actor killed it so greatly that you think you thought you get a bigger role now, pal. you're now going to be in so much more of this movie.
Yeah. In fact, one of the actors that I had in Six Guns for Hire, Patrick Kwok-Toon, who's in Star Trek Discovery.
He's awesome. Friend of the show.
He's great. He's a lovely dude. He and I had such a good time working together that I decided to basically write his character a son that could go have a story that would be played by him 25, 30 years later. So like I had this whole other thing I wanted to do with his character once I met him and played with him for a few days. And so, yeah, there have absolutely been actors that just blew me away. And I decided, okay, well, if that character dies in this film, that means I'm putting them in a prequel so that I can have them play more of this character. Or if I really love working with that actor and I want to see another color, another flavor that I know they have in them, I'll write them another character and put them in another film. Because the nice thing about the sixth verse is that I'm in this post-apocalypse, I've decided that there are so few human genomes left that you see the same faces coming up over and over and over in different bodies. And so it just lets me play with the same toys with a different paint job.
Well, you have two of my favorite actors and friends of the show, Patrick Kwok-Chun and Oyin Alatojo, who are very awesome. Like I said, great people. I got a pleasure talking with them. So how did they get involved in this film and these films? And is it, odd that they're both from Star Trek Discovery, or were they brought together because you know them? They were together. They worked together in Star Trek Discovery.
Well, you know, it's funny. I have an agency in Toronto that I'm with that I always like to fish through whenever I'm doing casting, because I know that my agency is going to be the easiest agency for me to get actors from. You know, I'm going to get a friggin' headache if I reach out to some other hard-ass agent that is just going to rake me through the coals. But if I talk to my own agency, they want me to hire my compatriots, basically. So I reached out to one particular agent and said, hey, you've got three people on your roster. Can I have them all? And I told them I told her exactly when I needed them. And she accused me of potentially reading her calendar, because I have found exactly the moments when they were available. Oyin and Patrick have crazy Star Trek schedules, especially during a pandemic. And Maurice Dean Wint, who was in RoboCop, the series, and played RoboCable, they were all available exactly when I needed them. And so I was interested in Oyin and Patrick because they were already bubbled together for Star Trek. And I knew that they could work together on set, because in my previous film, I did almost every actor one at a time. And on this one, I was going to have six people around a fire for a good chunk of the film. And I wanted each character to have a mirror that they could be with the whole time. And I wanted to shoot them out as three little sections of the fire. So I wanted Oyin and Patrick to be together. I wanted I had a preacher and a preacher's wife. I wanted those two to be together. So I hired a boyfriend, girlfriend couple that I knew could do the job, because I've worked with them both before. And then I hired Maurice Dean Wint with his old school chum, Juan Curan, who I'd worked with, my wife had worked with. He's a delightful guy. And they went to, I don't remember which school together, but they went to the same acting school. So everybody was in a group with somebody they already knew. And they were going to be shooting for, you know, the entire run of show with just their partner. And it made for something that was going to be felt more like theater to the actors, which was great. They, instead of being in a room with six people who had to each fight for the director's attention, I was talking to two people at once. And we were basically doing a two-hander, and I was getting to direct two people from Star Trek. So it was my dream to begin with. Hmm. And then they also enjoyed the hell out of it, to the point that the movie that I'm working on, that I'm co-directing in August, this just next month, Oyin asked if she could be a director trainee, because she had such a lovely time working with me and with my wife, Melissa. So now Oyin's going to be a part of the team as well. And then we're trying to make things work with Patrick, but the Star Trek schedule really threw things off for him. So I'm not sure that he's going to be able to be in it, but there's any movie I make, there's always a role for Patrick.
That's very cool. And when that movie's, you're ready to talk about that movie, come back and talk about that movie as well. So we definitely got to do that. As you mentioned before, you're shooting this through COVID, and you kind of mentioned the specific way you had to shoot it because of COVID. So because of COVID, did the movies still turn out the way you wanted them, or were they had to be adapted, you know, through script and everything else because of how COVID interfered?
You know, it's interesting. There weren't many changes in the script necessary, but the major thing that had to be changed from what I had originally planned was the production method. I originally, you know, it worked so well on Six Reasons Why. I wanted to take a bunch of actors out into a desert. Then I wanted to turn that desert in post-production into something heightened and crazy and post-apocalyptic. But because that was not going to be an option. I was going to have one actor at a time, so I couldn't go somewhere remote. I live in Toronto, Canada. It's like Manhattan. There's nowhere to take anybody. So what we did was we shot everything on green screen, and I worked with four of the most talented people I've met in my life, building virtual sets, building environments in post-production that are way more incredible than anything we could have had on set. So it's my imagination brought to life in a way that would have been impossible if we hadn't have needed to bring it down to nothing to figure out the parts that we could use to build it back up. Because never in a million years would I have thought that this was the best way to shoot this Western. But goddamn, it was.
Well, also, and as a common thread through all his movies, is one of my favorite actors, Colm Feore, who everyone knows from The Umbrella Academy, and you know, it's just awesome. And there's a gravitas to that guy. So what was he like to work with, and how is his character or characters essential to this trilogy, or was it sixology? I don't know what a six film franchise is called.
A sixology?
Sixology. What, a very cool ology. How's it connected to all of it?
Sweet ology. Well, you know, it's funny. Colm, I met him before we made Six Reasons Why, because my brother and I wrote this character that needed, like you said, gravitas. And my brother and I took my mom to the Stratford Festival to watch him perform Coriolanus for her birthday. My mother does not enjoy Shakespeare by any stretch, but the whole idea was go there and ambush Colm Feore with the movie's opening sequence that we had designed with his face in it, featuring Colm Feore, this whole animated James Bond styles, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly style opening sequence. And when he saw it, he basically just said, okay, figure out what time works with my agent. This is incredible. And so Colm wanted to be in the film after that. And we, you know, accommodated his agency at every turn. Every time they put a roadblock in our way, we figured out how to surmount it. And we wound up shooting with Colm on Six Reasons Why. And I've shot with him on almost every film I've made since then, because we became lovely friends. He was such a champion of Six Reasons Why. The very year that we were releasing Six Reasons Why, we had a finished version and we were ready to sell it. It just so happened he was one of the judges at the Toronto International Film Festival. So he was on radio shows and Entertainment Tonight specials and red carpets everywhere. And people would ask him what he's up to. And he would say, well, I shot this cool, weird little Western, Six Reasons Why. It's for sale now. And so Colm happened to open every little door with all these little things he said, to the point that we got an Entertainment Tonight special about this crazy $10,000 movie we had made. And one thing led to another. The thing sold in an international bidding war, and now it's available around the world. And he's just been in... He's been willing to work on all the stuff I've done since then. And it's been an absolute delight every single time, because he's a marvelous dude. He's got such great stories, an incredible work ethic. The guy will pick up sandbags and help you haul them from one place to another. Like he just, he's the antithesis of a diva, and is such an absolute pleasure to hang with.
Well, like I said, you worked with Colm Feore in 2008, pre-Umbrella Academy. Now you're working with him post-Umbrella Academy, where he's now huge, absolutely huge. Did he come in like with like an entourage the second, third films? Was it, you know, is there any difference in what you knew from the 2008 version?
Oh, not at all. I mean, the nice thing about Colm is he and I have been keeping up and doing stuff together over the years. So it was nice to, especially on 6 Days to Die, nobody was working at all. So when I called him up and said, hey, I got a movie, do you want to be in it? He was like, dear Lord, Matt, yes. How, you're in work? Excellent. And then he was so happy, because the only thing he had done in 8 months had been an audiobook, because nobody had cracked the nut on how to get back to get back to shooting. Then when it came time to shoot Six Guns for Hire, everyone had kind of figured out the thing that I figured out. And so we tried to shoot with him during Principal Photography and Umbrella Academy was shooting. But Umbrella Academy doesn't just shoot you the days you need to be there. Umbrella Academy buys your ass for 6 months. You can't do anything, go anywhere, do anything until you've wrapped the season. Because otherwise, one person gets COVID, the whole production gets bumped, and it's a big mess. But we wound up shooting all of Six Guns for Hire in, I want to say, March. And then we brought Colin back in September to fill in all his gaps because we were shooting everything modularly. We were shooting things on green. So we were able to put Colm in a scene with like seven people, most of which he had never met. And it was effortless. It was just like shooting 6 days to Die. It was great.
Like I said, that sounds awesome. So you're doing this film, the setting of the story is definitely like a character in the film. So how is it impactful to the story itself? Why could it not be told in any other setting?
The world that this is based in is one that kind of takes the idea of xenophobia into a place that just doesn't exist right now and really hasn't in the Wild West. There's the area that Colm Feore's character, sort of his fiefdom, is a kingdom that is cut off from all of humanity. So they've kind of evolved in their own way in 200 years, terrified of the things that are outside of the walls of their city. Because during the apocalypse that caused all of this, humans who mutated became truly monstrous. Genomes were scrambled with bears and wolves and all kinds of deadly creatures, part human, part animal, roamed the wastelands. And so they built those walls up and stayed safe. And 200 years have gone by, those things are gone, but they don't really know anything but fear and scarcity. And so that little world has no idea that outside of it, there's this wonderful return to technology that's happening. So there's a railroad that one man is obsessed with building directly back to that utopian little group of xenophobes. And so as you work your way along this train, the growth of humanity kind of follows along. You've got boom towns at the outside, and as you work your way in, the towns get a little more advanced, the technology's a little more ubiquitous, and it gets a little more like Blade Runner the farther in you go, and a little more like Once Upon a Time in the West the farther out you go. So it gives me the chance to play in noir as well as the Western genre, as well as the horror genre. So there's a lot of world that I get to plumb inside of this custom-made little post-apocalyptic Earth that I've built. So it's kind of the only setting I could tell this story in.
Like I said, it sounds absolutely awesome. So when can our listeners find these movies? When are they going to be released?
Well, Six Reasons Why is currently available on highballtv.com. So you can rent it or you can subscribe for 2 weeks free and watch it and then bail. But whatever, however you want to watch it there.
And that Amazon is Prime. Also,
it's also on Amazon Prime, yeah. And so you can also pick up DVDs to get special features if you find like the eBay versions of the disc, because there's some pretty cool special features we put on that thing. But when it comes to 6 Days to Die, the plan is for that to be released at a like genre heavy, cool festival this fall. We're trying to figure out which one it's going to be. And as soon as I know which one it is, I will be sure to let you know, Jeff. And then for Six Guns for Hire, that's one that I want to have hot on the heels of 6 Days to Die. So hopefully that'll be something we can put out in the spring of 2023.
Very cool, sir. That sounds both awesome. And please let me know exactly when they're released and we'll add them to our video edit anyway. And awesome. I want to thank you so much for talking with me. You're fantastic. And I look forward to these movies.
Jeff, it's my absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, and I'm happy to talk about any of these movies anytime you want. Love it. I can't wait. Thank you, Jeff.